Okay, I'm going to do a reading from Ajahn Sucitto. It's from his blog that he does on the internet. And this is called Awareness, Nameless and Stopped. One of the monks asked a renowned forest Ajahn, "What's it like to see things as they really are?" There was an understandable air of expectation in the room. To see things as they really are, yathābhūtaṁ ñāṇadāsanaṁ, is the vision of the awakened mind. What mystical insight was about to be revealed? "It's ordinary," said the Ajahn in his customary succinct and matter-of-fact way. Bodhidharma, the legendary conveyor of the Chan transmission of Dhamma to China, had an exchange with the emperor that was similar in tone. The emperor, who had devotedly built temples and shrines throughout China, implored the master, "What is the essence of the holy truth?" "Emptiness, no holiness," replied the sage. Awakening is more of a deflation of the mind than a peak experience. That's why it's difficult to grasp. Actually, emptiness, until you understand it as the non-clingable, signless quality of what arises, does give one something a little mystical to cling to. Perhaps the emperor wasn't ready for the really direct teaching. Subsequent Chan masters who were teaching committed disciples tended to either tell them to wash their bowls or whack them with a stick. The point is that the closer you get to the Dhamma, the more directly it is attuned to, the more you know that appearances aren't where it's at. But then whatever arises is experienced as just so. Then nothing is being made out of anything. Just this is the unconstructed, atamayata, and the end to the conceiving, favoring, and proliferations of the mind. Things are as they are, but the mind's awareness is peaceful, clear, and awake. As indicated, the language to describe such fruition turns normal expectations inside out. Frequently, awareness is said to be released through the stopping or cessation of consciousness. A related example from the Pali Canon is Bhikkhuni Pattachara's experience of awakening. Returning to her dwelling after a period of walking meditation, her realization occurred as she turned down the flame of her lamp. Like the going out of a flame was the release of awareness. That was from the Tarikatha. No blazing light, but just the opposite. Is awakening some kind of coma? Well, this apparent paradox occurs because consciousness is not fully understood. Awareness as consciousness is the sixfold awareness that processes data through eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and thinking mind. In this setup, mind consciousness, mano vijnana citta, is the awareness that is affected by the perceptions and feelings that arise from external sense contact, and also from the internal, that is mind, base. So as we know for ourselves, the mind is always being affected, and as such, it's fluttering on the run or sliding from this to that. Now, maybe if all that flittering and chattering were to stop, that would be a stilling of an activity rather than an annihilation of anything solid, which is exactly the point. It also explains why the language of awakening is distinctly unexciting and doesn't get one's pulses racing. For awakening, whatever gets consciousness running has to be revealed, directly known and relinquished. And this relinquishment, again, isn't an annihilation, but a letting go of the reactivity that keeps us spinning. It's all in the mind. The mind base is the home of the impulses and psychological activities, the citta sankhara, which stimulate consciousness for good or for bad. On investigation, these activities of liking, disliking, of hesitancy or eagerness, are seen as arising dependent on our attitudes and subjectively based perceptions. We acquire these perceptual references over the course of time. Whether a taste is delicious or music pleasant, and what an arrangement of letters on a page means, all gets learned from paying attention and assessing results, such as that forming words helps you to communicate with other humans, and that's useful. This is how consciousness is activated and programmed. These activities, these sankhara, are also called formations, in that through their activity, an impression, a perception of what's out there, gets formed. And not only that, formations form and define a me as lively, articulate, passionate, even-minded, or dull. So the solidity of our world and our self is based upon activities and formations. And what if they stopped? In that freeing up, in things really being seen as they are, the world and the self neither exist nor don't exist. They both arise dependently. One point to emphasize is that the me sense is a solidification of the sense of presence that is the resonance of consciousness. It takes form dependent on the perceptions and feelings that consciousness forms, infers, and otherwise derives from sense contact. When an architect looks at a building, he or she becomes an architect. That particular sense of self doesn't arise as they eat a meal or watch TV. And in that mode, he or she sees something different from that which is seen by a thief. The individual bias, the acquired activity, forms an impression both of the subject and the object. Even more pertinent, when pain or displeasure touch the heart, I get formed as the victim of that. With pleasure, I become the owner. Then I get defensive or acquisitive and act accordingly. Instant comma. Have you seen or felt who you become when guilt or fear gets into you, or when compassion or joy touches your heart? Being touched is a formation. Contact or impression, pasa, is an activity that modifies and colors the sense of self. In this respect, I'm referring not so much to direct sensory contact or impingement contact, patika pasa, but the impression that the mind makes of that contact, called designation contact, adivachana pasa. This form of contact is a significant one. Owing to the subjective flavoring of designation contact, different people find different sights, sounds, flavors, ideas, remarks, and gestures delightful, repugnant, or neutral. Designation contact sets up the familiar pattern of how we experience the world, and the consequent perceptions and impressions guide what we will make impingement contact with in the future. So this is the key to how we react and create fresh action, or kama, based on the blueprint of the past, only to discover that what was wonderful once becomes same old thing the third time round. Amazingly enough, as if that detail of understanding consciousness wasn't enough, the Buddha was able to go deeper and witness the various aspects of these sankhara activities that accompany mind consciousness. These mental activities, these jitta sankhara, are the subjective attention, manasikara, that notices what interests or repels or otherwise activates me, the designation contact, whose action is to name an experience accordingly as not as good as, wonderful, and a long list of etc., and the psychological impulse, volitional twitch, or go-for-it intention, jetana, that rises up as a response. Combined with perception and mental feelings that they generate, attention, contact, and intention make up what is termed as name, nama. The sting in this apparently neutral functioning is that when it gets infected with ignorance, the mind takes as real, substantial, and potentially acquirable what in fact has been formed by consciousness. So that stirs consciousness into chasing its tail, motivated by either acquisition, aversion, or delusion, of which three, Delusion is the one that is most constantly streaming in. The deluded consciousness imagines that the sense of presence, which is its own resonance, is some lasting immaterial self that might acquire or be the unwilling recipient of what is passing through it. Seemingly inevitable and occasionally cute and endearing, it is this sense of self with its restless need that forms in the stream of name and feeds greed and hatred. He's got a couple quotes from the Sanyutta Nikaya. Name has weighed down everything. Nothing is more extensive than name. Name is the one thing that has all under its control. From where do the streams turn back? Where does the round no longer revolve? Where does name and form cease, stop without remainder? Where water, earth, fire, and air do not gain a footing. It is from here that the streams turn back, here that the round no longer revolves. Here name and form ceases, stops without remainder. So, if instead of creating fantasies and phobias, those streams were to stop, intellectually, it's not difficult to repudiate delusion. As far as we can see in the experienced cosmos, there's no such thing as a thing. From the stars and rocks on down to the oscillating cells in our bodies and our flickering thoughts, it's all dynamic. How could there be a permanent self? But in all this movement, there's one process that forms that apparent self. It's the lock of grasping. And that occurs in the citta sankhara when it's infected by ignorance. In its psychic theater of me in here having things done to me by the world out there, this mental activity formulates perceptions and mental feelings, emotional complexes, that establish a me in a stream of suffering and stress. From the sense of me aiming to or about to get what I want, me being rejected, what am I going to do about, issue powerful emotions of greed, impatience, depression, resentment, anxiety, and the rest. Consequently, the mind gets overwhelmed and loses clarity and presence. We may despair and blame our dissonances on the world, on others, or on ourself, but in reality, it's all down to ignorance with regard to these activities or formations. So, if this stress is the result of activities, how can I make those activities stop? To elaborate on this end, the canon, in the form of formula of dependent arising, presents how awareness is conditioned, and in its reverse sequence, how awareness is released. And as another paradox, it's not a matter of me stopping anything. With the complete and dispassionate fading of ignorance comes around the ceasing of the activities. With the ceasing of the activities is the ceasing of consciousness. With the ceasing of consciousness, the ceasing of name and form. Or, to put it another way, when ignorance isn't active, the activities that bias awareness don't come into play. When these activities stop or don't arise, the process of naming or creating designations that solidify into apparently real things, forms, also stops. The keynote is dispassionate. Remember that intention is part of the nama package that we're looking to stop. In fact, it's a crucial piece. Although perceptions and feelings are the movers that get us jumping, intention, which steers attention, is what's set up the basis to acquire them in the first place. Because we are motivated to belong, be happy, and get ahead, attention gets primed to reach out for the feel-good factor and register those perceptions and impressions that most immediately hit that button. Of course, these aren't always the most useful in the long term, but what gets sustained is that, although this one didn't quite do it, there's a perception out there or in here that will take me where I want to go. Have you ever heard the, if only this wasn't happening, or the, it should be, or she or I should be? Perpetually unfulfilled, that self is looking to fulfill its perceptual dreams. And alongside it runs its partner, this isn't good enough, which swells into, it's not fair, and goes viral with, there's something wrong with me, I didn't make it. So to quit suffering, you have to stop searching for the right perception. And therefore, in meditation, rather than sustain perceptions even of formlessness and space, it's wiser to relax the intention to acquire, or to assume one has acquired, anything. As one passage in the canon indicates, even perceptions of realization are to be allowed to pass. This is Sariputta speaking. I attained to samadhi of such a sort that in earth I was unaware of earth. In this world, in the world beyond, I was unaware of it, and yet, at the same time, I was percipient. One perception arose in me. To end becoming is nibbana. Another perception faded out in me. To end becoming is nibbana. Just as, friend, from a fire of splinters, one spark arises and another spark fades out, in such a way one perception arose. To end becoming is nibbana, and another perception, to end becoming is nibbana, faded out in me. Yet at the same time, friend, I consciously perceived. And that's in the Anguttara Nikaya. These statements suggest that with awakening, there is no sensed object. And yet when mind consciousness is stopped, turned back from the designation process of name and form, and relinquishing even the cognitive knowing of that state of emptiness, it does offer clear vision. So correct cultivation has to be in line with disengagement and dispassion, a moderation of intention that culminates in stopping and relinquishment. It's a good reminder. Relinquishment of intention is the mark of an Aryan, a mark whose significance is that when we meditate and loosen our conscious intentions, most of us meet an arising of residual memories and impulses. To be able to relinquish intention and stay clear requires a training in emptying the mind of me and mine. Personally, I find that very grounding. Dhamma practice isn't bound by time, place, or what arises. It's a matter of meeting what arises, disengaging, softening and relaxing the reactive intention, and then widening the span of attention to include awareness of intention itself. Furthermore, if we widen to attune to how any contact affects the body, especially around the eyes, forehead, and solar plexus, it's possible to relax and release things right there. In the traditional context, many people had realizations outside of a formal meditation practice, but they all trained in applying the mind to what arises at any level. In a bygone age, that meant dealing with poor food, unheated crude dwellings, sickness, and rigorous routines with very little sensory distraction for the mind to go out to. See what arises, meet it, and release it at that point. In such cases, effort isn't egotistical willpower, but an expression of what it takes to get through a day of hardship without psychologically cracking up. To enter and persist in such environments required a strong aspiration with the need to continually renew determination and patient endurance. The meditation technique was simple, like reciting Bhutto with each breath, because it was conducted within a training that cleared the path by subjecting intention, attention, and contact to a rigorous workout. And if the natural environment couldn't work you over, then the teacher would. Ajahn Chah commented that his technique was to frustrate his disciples. Marpa had Milarepa construct and demolish buildings as a practice. Most of the instructions of the Thai forest masters was on directing attention towards looking after the bowls, robes, and kutis, cleaning the toilets, attending to elders, and cultivating restraint around food and looking at corpses a lot. So it isn't the object or the perception that counts in itself, but using them to restrain the outgoing impulses and give attention in areas that challenge the notion of having things go one's way. The beauty of this is that it makes the practice universal. Appearances change, but practicing with the pressures and the designation impressions of me suffering is still the heart of Buddha Dhamma. Most of the work of the practice, then, is just about noticing what stimulates, alarms, or otherwise pushes our buttons and working with that. It's about restraining the freewheeling mind, turning away from sources of powerful attraction, checking the impulses and reactions, softening the ill will and tension, and widening into the body to release the energy of the activation. And more subtly, it's about meeting and disengaging the should-bes. So, I walk up and down my meditation path, feeling nothing special, and practice staying with that. Facing a group of school children and wanting to bring something into their lives that will withstand the floods of commercialism, I hold and relax with that. Or, at a management meeting, I listen to the gloomy analysis of the monastery's finances without dismissing or panicking over that. Meet it, disengage from the script of it, even as you widen to receive its wave, and let that move through you. Then trust what arises within when the self-impression passes. Investigate the dukkha of how it should be, because with unerring simplicity, release always comes down to cultivation of the Four Noble Truths. Selfless clarity, vijja, spontaneously arises with their comprehension. What arises by itself after the release is the true guide, and it's nobody's. The awareness that is liberated through such a realization is just anya, the knowing. It's a knowing that has no subject, a development based on, but beyond, the mindful knowing and witnessing of what arises. At each stage of awakening, as places where self-view congregates get freed, there is the knowing, dispassionate and free from positions. And the Buddha constantly refused to make a self out of that. This is a quote from the Sanyutta Nikaya. A tangle inside, a tangle outside. This generation is entangled in a tangle. I ask you this, O Gotama, who can disentangle this tangle? Where name and form ceases, stops without remainder, and also impingement and perception of form, it is here this tangle is cut. And to be even more pithy, there is the conclusion of the brief exchange between the emperor and Bodhidharma. Then who is this who stands before me? Your Majesty, I don't know.
Comments, questions?
Does Bodhigiri have its own copy of Kor Wat? In the library I saw for a lot on the chat, there's some papers. So Bodhigiri has something similar to that.
Not really. I mean, it's part of it is, it's taken from the Vinaya, mostly taken from the Vinaya. And then it's it's passed on. A lot of the, you've got Vinaya standards, which are quite extensive, that are, call what is, what the word what is, comes from in Thai, but in Pali it's watta, which is duties. And there's extensive delineation of various duties that the Buddha lays down in terms of relationship to bowl, to teacher, to dining hall, to the sauna, there's all these. So those standards get laid down, and then each particular monastery will have certain ways of incorporating that. And it gets passed on. And then it also, it changes over time as well. It has a life of its own.
That's part of what I like about living in a community like this, is that most of those things are not written down in a book. So you can go reference them, because so much of the Dhamma for me is taking what's written down in a book as a reference and turning that into a living experience. And that's what's the bowl washing and everything like that has helped me to do that.
Those become areas of an area of learning. That's really important.
Not being a monastic, can you talk about the bowl washing? I mean, it's an exercise of mindfulness, I assume, but is there instructions that you give?
Oh, yeah. Don't bang the bowl, don't scrape the bowl, don't put it down in odd places where it's going to be kicked or peed on by a dog. In Thailand, that's a big thing. Fortunately, we have a kaw wat here. I'm not encouraging animals. And then washing it, drying it, putting it out in the sun. So that it takes the smell away, taking it back, putting the covers on, and making sure they're not, when you set it down somewhere, it's not in somebody's way, or it's not close to the edge of the counter. Those all parts of the training that's laid down to the Buddha, and then you interpret it for the particular situation out there. You're in. It's like here.
When we ordain, we're taught to treat the bowl as if it's the Buddha's head. That kind of respect.
That's why you're not allowed to talk when you're watching the bowl. Isn't that right?
Well, we try.
In a perfect world. One of the aspects of that reading that I found very interesting is, towards the end, Ajahn Suchita was talking about how dealing with all the difficulties of jungle monastery life in Thailand developed the qualities he was describing. But then there was sort of an implication that, right now, conditions are different, but then, we have, and so, but these principles keep applying.
Yeah.
That's pretty critical, because if you succeed at this, it's hard not to be supported well. That's just what happens, and then, unless you can figure out how to keep the practice going in a different environment, you won't keep succeeding.
The truth of the Buddha's teachings is not dependent on a particular time or a particular place. I mean, it's true everywhere at all times. So that, of course, it's up to us to learn how to live it. And learn how to apply it so that whatever situation we're in, obviously within certain boundaries, as a monastic, and you have quite clear boundaries. And there's all, but as a monastic, then you still are coming in contact with all sorts of different situations.
He emphasized in that a lot of chetana for attenuating even form, whereas I think seeing the Buddhist teaching as well as honestly, for our attention, the foundation of mindfulness is radically attending to things like the body or 32 parts, whatever. So the training of the Buddha in many ways is designed to attenuate conception of name and form by radically attending to. And he gives you stock ways of training to do that. So you don't need to necessarily have somebody making your life uncertain. The meditation can also be utilized to break down perception.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just curious on one thing that in the talk that Ajahn Dev was reading, there's a come up with like a name and form ceases, name and form ceases.
Yes.
And I was I remember at one time a Brahma something like that the Buddha said we asked the wrong question, and it's not that the name and form ceases, but it's the name and form do not arise. So what the difference between those two contexts?
Well, part of it is, especially when you start talking about, it's part of its language, and then of course with the way that we conceive, so because one of the problems with, say with a language speaking of cessation, then it implies the cessation of an existing thing. But then when it's a dynamic or process, then that trying to make it cease is you end up in kind of solidifying it or reifying it. And what is probably more useful in terms of concept, how we conceive of it, so that the non-arising is so that there isn't that whole process arising. So then it ceases to be a problem. So it's hard. So that's where it's hard. You have to describe it, but then the language sometimes trips us up. But that sense of that non-arising is a very interesting way to conceive of it. So that it doesn't turn into something that we solidify and invest in, whether it's an object or a subject. Any questions?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about if there's a precise definition for when talking about sankharas arising from greed, hatred, and delusion. Of like greed and hatred are pretty clear to me, but delusion I feel like I can think of in a few different ways. And whether, I don't know, it was a specific or not.
No, I mean it's just, it doesn't really matter how you define it. You know, there isn't any delineation. It's whenever sankharas arise with whether it's greed, hatred, or delusion, doesn't really matter, then it's going to create dukkha. When there's a lot of it is looking at the stress, that kind of the feeling of suffering, discontent, dissatisfaction, dis-ease, that one feels in the system. Because, of course, like, metta is a sankhara. Mindfulness is a sankhara. Wisdom is a sankhara. So it isn't as if you're trying to annihilate sankharas. But it's that recognition of, that's the investigation of understanding where is the dukkha in this? It's the understanding of dukkha, cessation of dukkha. We have to pay attention to.
Okay.